first case for argument, United States v. McBride. Mr. Anderson.
May it please the Court, my name is Howard Anderson. I represent the defendant, Mr. McBride. Mr. McBride was convicted at a bench trial on four counts, but the merits of only two counts are at issue on appeal. Those two counts are conspiracy to launder money in count three and arson in count four. We are asking the Court to reverse those two convictions for insufficiency of the evidence.
Are you puzzled by this joint motion to remand?
Yes, Your Honor.
This is a confession of error by the government, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, for sentencing purposes.
I don't understand. You have other grounds, right?
In the motion, we're asking after you consider the merits of the appeal to the remand for a new sentencing. So if the court reverses the conviction, obviously there will be no resentencing or no retrial on count three or count four if those counts are reversed. So it's only for counts.
Wait, I don't understand.
We're asking for a resentencing.
So suppose we reverse on the arson and the money laundering conspiracy. That has no implications for sentencing? Is that what you're suggesting?
I know, Your Honor. We all agree that if you reverse any count, a full resentencing is required. And we also agree that if you reverse no count, a full resentencing is required. And the reason for the latter is because there was an error in the calculation of the guideline sentence.
I understand, but that's not the only ground on which you want a resentencing, right?
It's our position that you shouldn't even consider the money laundering and arson because he's actually...
Well, doesn't that affect the sentence? I don't understand.
It would, Your Honor. Yes, as I laid out in my opening brief.
Yes. What are you talking about?
If you were to reverse either the money laundering or the arson count.
Suppose we reverse both of them. Doesn't that have implications for sentencing?
Yes, Your Honor, it would.
But that goes beyond what the joint remand is about, right?
The motion confesses error for the miscalculation of the sentence and asks after you consider the merits of counts three and count four to then remand for resentencing rather than having the government proceed on its arguments that there was no error in the sentencing. Okay. As for count three, the conspiracy to launder money, a conspiracy is a partnership in crime, and a partnership requires two people who have the same intentions.
Why?
Because that's what a partnership is.
Why should it matter for conspiracy if some of the small fry don't actually know what's going on?
Because the Supreme Court has said that a conspiracy of one is legally impossible, so there have to be two people who have an agreement.
Is there a reason for this, or is this just some kind of semantic thing?
Judge, a conspiracy draws on the language of partnership, and so just like you can't have a partnership of one, you can't have a conspiracy of one.
Isn't it a less important role?
Pardon?
Didn't it come down, she just deposited money and other things. She wasn't. Is important, I guess.
Right. As I read the transcript, she's and as a district court,
she knew what was going on. And money, the amounts of money, she knew that didn't cover the little nothing store.
But knowing what's going on is not the same as intending to launder money.
No, but she knows. But she was totally willfully blind. Far too much cash. There is prior fact could find that the two of them engaged in a case.
But the trial judge said that he found her testimony truthful. And in her testimony, she said that she only found it odd that she was depositing $270,000 in cash.
Odd?
Yes, Your Honor. That was
the
government's word.
Where did the money came from?
The government did not inquire about that.
Where did the money came from?
The government did not inquire.
Where do you think she thought the money came from?
I think she I think she was willfully blind and that she didn't want to know.
Willfully blind?
As she testified.
Well, wait a second. That's a confession. Willfully blind is the, you know, that's the ostrich situation. That's the same thing as knowing.
But before a conspiracy, knowledge is not enough. You must intend, not mere knowledge.
I don't see the difference. You're helping someone you know, or you're willfully blind and failing to know that this is criminal proceeds. What more do you need for conspiracy?
Well, Your Honor, I would say, one, that there is a major difference between knowledge and intention. So, for example, in Hunt, this court said that there must be a conspiracy and the defendant, which requires the government to show that the defendant, one, knew that the conspiracy existed, and two, intended to join it. So knowledge and intent are not the same thing.
If you know you're helping someone, why doesn't that make you a conspirator?
In the language of the...
You know you're assisting a person in criminal activity. Why shouldn't that be sufficient?
Because a conspiracy requires there to be a partnership. She has to share...
Come on, how about some common sense? You know that you're helping a person commit illegal activities, right? And you hope to profit from it, right?
Under the money laundering...
Why isn't that enough? Give me a reason why it isn't enough.
Because conspiracy is a special type of crime.
Just why?
Because you get tagged with acts that you yourself not commit. So this court, for example, has said that there has to be substantial evidence of a conspiracy because the nature of conspiracy
There's
is...
There's plenty of evidence. I don't understand.
She has to have intended to launder the money, not merely known that's what Mr. McBride wanted to do. She has to have...
Wait a minute. She knows... that he wants her to launder the money, and she does it. And that isn't enough?
No, Your Honor.
No, it's not enough? Wow.
She has to herself actively want to launder money.
What do you actually want? It's enough if you agree with someone else to do it. You have to want.
She has to intend to launder the money, Your Honor.
She went to a bank, right? Deposited more than $10,000.
Yes, Your Honor.
And normally, when a bank and structure on that sort of thing, they have to go through a bunch of hoops to deposit $10,000 or more in cash.
Yes, Your Honor.
Apparently, that bank was not as scrutinizing as others. Therefore, that's why she went all the way to Chicago to find that bank. Wasn't aware of that if you went to the local bank, they'd say $25,000 or something, they might start filling out forms and things?
Her testimony in the record was that she just thought it was odd that Mr. McBride asked her to go from Peoria to Chicago to deposit all this money.
The only odd part is that she just didn't keep going. She went and deposited $25,000 in cash. That's pretty amazing trust in someone.
Well, I mean, as I look at her...
It had no other interest in it.
As I look at her testimony, she seems to be just a girlfriend who's doing what her boyfriend's telling her to do. And so that's, I think, why she didn't go off to Canada.
Was she prosecuted?
She was prosecuted, and she pleaded guilty under a separate cross.
Well, that... What was she prosecuted for?
It was either... either money laundering or conspiracy to launder money. I don't remember which.
She was prosecuted for conspiracy and she pleads guilty? Isn't that quite pertinent?
No, Your Honor, because her testimony has to be in this case in the record, and so there was no factual basis where she said, yes, I wanted to launder money, and so that's what she would have had to say as part of her plea colloquy for the court to have sentenced her as a money laundering conspirator.
She didn't cooperate or testify in the prosecution, is that correct?
She did, Your Honor. So
she's cooperating.
She was testifying in this case under a plea agreement with the government.
Yeah, but when she testifies, aren't there some questions asked about and all that sort of thing after she's already pleaded?
I think at the time she just had the plea agreement, but I don't think she had gone in for that. So The plea agreement was introduced.
Was that a contingency that she cooperate under the plea agreement?
Yes, she was required to cooperate in her testimony. And so again, Your Honor, it's my position that you can't square in the record the district court's finding that her testimony was, one, truthful, and two, that she had a quote-unquote inkling as to what was going on, with the requirement that she have intended to join a criminal conspiracy. And, Your Honor, rather than address the other issues now, I'll just preserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Ms. Mullen?
May it please the Court, Linda Mullen on behalf of the United States. Typically, I would...
I'm puzzled by your position about arson. I don't understand what the government's conception of arson offense is. I think it's irrelevant that it's a person's own property that is...
Yes, we think that there's nothing in the federal arson statute.
So if you light a candle, your own candle, you're guilty of arson?
Well, no, because you have to have malicious intent. I mean, the maliciousness and the commerce element are still in there. But we do believe that it is not a component of the federal arson statute that you burn someone else's property. And the reason for that is arson by its very nature is releasing a destructive force. And so,
well, is it? It's not in my candle case, is it?
No, but you're not, you know, you're not.
Well, what is the destructive force here?
Well, let's look at the facts of this case. We have an operating retail business. We have a defendant who goes.
How big was this business? How big was the building?
I don't know exactly how big the building was. I've seen pictures
exactly
of it, but it's
approximately will do nicely.
I would say it's the size of what you would typically see a store in a strip mall being. So it wasn't the size of a supersized Gap.
Is that in the record?
No, I've seen pictures of it, but I'm guessing.
You've seen pictures, but they're not in the
record. Oh, no, the pictures are in the record. I'm saying I don't have measurements of the store to offer to you.
Was the store attached on both sides to other stores?
That is not clear. And that is not clear from the record. But any time you set fire
to
an...
So you don't know whether it was attached. You don't know how large it is.
I can tell you that I inquired about both of those things, and those are not in the record.
I'm not interested in what's not in the record. Was the fire department called?
Yes.
How do you know?
That is in the record. So, again, and that's what I was getting to, Judge
Posner.
I'm sorry?
They put out the fire?
Yes, they did put out the fire.
Did it burn itself out?
No, they put out the fire. And so there's water damage to the items in the store.
And that's in the record?
That is in the record. So... You know, any time you have an operating retail business and you light an uncontrolled fire, you torch the business under cloak of darkness without anyone there to control what's going on, you have malicious intent. You are doing something intentionally with disregard of the damage that it can cause or the injury it can cause. Regardless of whether ultimately it does cause damage or injury to other people, you have firemen responding to that scene who can be hurt in putting out the fire. You might have a good Samaritan who strolls by and decides to help. The fire may get out of control because of wind conditions or something else, or the fire department doesn't respond on time.
You know, the defendant claims he can burn down his own shed. 5-acre.
And that may be the case, Judge Rovner. Maybe. If that shed is not operating in interstate commerce and he wants to burn his own shed because he's going, you know, I don't know, he wants to make room for a swing set for his grandkids, I don't think that would violate the federal arson statute. I mean, you'd need to get a burn permit. And
house.
I'm sorry?
House.
I don't think he can burn down his own house.
But
I think then we're dealing with gas lines.
Shed.
Well, I think that if you have a shed in the middle of 25 acres and, you know, hopefully you would follow city ordinances in terms of getting burn permits and things like that, and you do it in a controlled way, that might fall outside of the federal arson statute. But here, we're not anywhere close to examples like that. This is an operating retail store. This is clearly within the confines of the federal arson statute.
Was there no insurance fraud issue here?
No, that was not part of the record, Judge Rovner. Again, I think that the under the federal arson statute, of course, we don't have to prove that there was any insurance fraud. And I think that the prosecutor, in approaching this, was seeing this as classic arson. I mean, we clearly have something operating in commerce, right? This is not a question, as the defense is trying to depict it on appeal, of, gosh, this was closed for the night, this preposterous suggestion, therefore it's no longer in commerce because I don't have any interest in continuing with the business. So that's a purely legal argument. It doesn't really make any sense. And clearly, a retail business is operating in commerce. And so I think that the prosecutor felt like, we don't need to prove any
more
than
that. Well, what if the shed was in commerce? Would that make a difference?
I think that if the shed is in commerce and you maliciously burn it, then yes, that would make a difference and fall within the federal arson statute.
Maliciously meaning what in this context?
That you have the intent. I think maliciously is defined in the common law as having the intent to damage or destroy.
Yes, but so in the candle case, if you intend to burn the candle, that's malice.
I think that we have to look at the purpose for a candle, like the other example that's used, which is charcoal, is to burn. And so I don't know that that's intentionally damaging.
I'm just asking about your concept of malice.
Mm-hmm.
So if I intend to burn a candle, to light a candle, that is a malicious act?
No, I would say that it isn't, because I would say you're not harming. It's intentional, yes, but you're not harming or destroying.
Well, where is harm in the definition of malice?
Well, it is the willful, it's the intention to do harm or the willful disregard that you're going to do harm.
Suppose that you burn down your house because mm-hmm. you're tired of it, you want a new house. You don't intend to harm anybody else, you just intend to destroy the house. Now, is that malicious?
Yes, because you're acting with willful disregard that could happen, and that's part of the definition of
willful
malice.
Willful disregard of what?
Look, that you're going to create damage or injury.
Willful disregard is secondary to intent.
Mm-hmm.
I thought your conception of malice is intent.
We say
primary
in our brief,
intent and secondarily willful disregard. Now, if I light a candle, isn't that a malicious act? It may not be actionable, but isn't it malicious? That is, doesn't it satisfy the definition of malice as intentional?
Well, I don't process it that way, Judge Posner, because I think when you're lighting a candle, you're not damaging
you're
the candle in the
sense.
You're
intending to destroy the candle.
Yeah,
right?
But that's the
now,
purpose for the candle.
Now, isn't that malicious?
So you're not
intending? Look, do you think malice implies trying to harm people or firemen or insurance companies or what have you, or is malice simply the intent to start a fire?
I think malice is defined as intentionally or with willful disregard.
I don't want your definition. I want your answer to my question.
Well, that's
if
my
I
answer.
Light a candle, that's an intentional act.
Yes.
Now, is that malicious, or must there be some intent to do some larger damage than just to
I would say you're
candle.
And my answer to you, Judge Posner, is I don't think I understand you're destroying the candle in the sense that the candle is no longer going to be there, but you're not acting with malintent, with bad intent, because the candle
but
is designed to be burned.
But bad intent is not part of your definition of malice. Your definition of malice is intent, not bad intent.
With willful disregard of doing damage.
Now, look, forget willful disregard. That's another that's another subdivision of malice.
Yes.
What's the purpose of a
candle? Just focus on intent.
I interrupt you. What's the purpose of a candle?
The purpose of the candle is to provide lighting and ambiance.
Your birthday cake.
Or to blow out, to celebrate.
And what was the purpose of this building?
To have a retail store to sell clothing.
And it was ongoing.
Yes.
In the middle of the night.
Yes.
And he destroyed it.
Yes.
He's making a whole lot of money. And obviously this was, the way he put it, something he's tired of this, pain
mm-hmm.
in the neck.
Right.
So he burns it down.
Right.
That then invokes the federal statute. And the malicious is that he intentionally destroys a building.
That's right.
That is in the
commerce.
Stream of commerce.
Yes.
And people go there, not in the middle of the night, and that was what he did.
Right. There's a proper way to stop a building or to
well, what if he had a shed on his property, and in his shed he has some of the stuff that he sells from the store? But he's tired of that stuff, so he burns down the shed with the interstate shipments in it. Is that arson?
I think if he owns the property in the store and he removes that property from the store, which, by the way, in this case he did quite frequently to give his gifts and other things, he has then removed that personal property from commerce. And if he sticks in it in his shed and 6 months later decides the clothing's outdated and I'm not interested in the shed anymore and the shed's not in interstate commerce, then no, I don't think he's violated the federal arson
statute.
That sounds
exactly like this case.
But that isn't this case, because this case is an operational business.
He got tired of the store and everything in it, so he decided to torch it. Now, I understand.
But the shed's not in commerce.
Hey, don't interrupt me. If it was attached to other buildings and the fire department was called and so on, then there may have been danger, and that would be that would certainly be arson. But suppose it's freestanding, it's a little tiny store, no danger to anybody, fire department isn't called and so on. Then what's the difference between that and the shed case?
Well, the difference is the shed is not in commerce, and in the federal arson statute,
we understand you. The shed the shed is where he stores some of the inventory of his house. And you say, well, he can remove that from commerce and burn it down. Well, it's the same with the store. He decides the store contains a lot of junk, and he's tired of it, so he removes it from commerce and burns it, right? What's the difference?
Well, I think in your original hypothetical, he had removed things from
what's
the store
the
to put them into the store.
Well,
Judge Posner,
shed or it's a store, what's the difference?
I would love to answer your question, but I fear that I'm not going to get more than 3 or 4 words out before you're going to ask another one. And I will try not to interrupt you.
I promise not to interrupt.
All right, thank
What's
you.
The difference between burning down your shed, which contains inventory, and burning down your store?
If you have a shed and the purpose for the shed is to hold inventory for your store, then I would say the shed is in interstate commerce, and then if you torch it, you violate the federal arson statute.
No, but you said earlier you could say you were removing the contents of the shed from interstate commerce, tired of them, and then you could burn the shed.
Well,
you say you can't do it with the store.
Right. What I'm saying,
so
Judge Posner, is it depends on what the function of the shed is. We need to see the function of the shed to know whether or not it's in commerce.
What's the function of the shed?
If the function of the shed is to hold inventory for the store and circulate that inventory in and out of the store, then I think it is in commerce. And then I think if you do torch it maliciously, then you're guilty of arson.
But you said if the owner decides that he's not going to sell it anymore, he's tired of it, then he can burn it.
What I said was, if he removes inventory from the store, let's say he decides that he wants some winter coats for the family for Christmas, and he's storing them in a shed on his property, he forgets about them. He doesn't give them to the kids for Christmas. Now they're moth-eaten. It's 6 months later. He's not going to return them. He's not using the shed as a storage facility for inventory. Then I think if he decided, while I'm torching the shed to build the swing set for the grandkids that didn't get the winter coats, I'm going to go ahead and burn the coats that are in there too, then I don't think that's in commerce.
So suppose that he decides everything the same with his store. He closes the store, he padlocks it, it's finished with selling from the store, and then he torches it. What's the difference?
Because a retail store is in commerce. So
he's abandoned commerce. He's closed it. It's not in commerce.
But it's clear from Supreme Court case law and cases out of this court that that's not enough to say I made a decision on a Thursday night.
Well, you said
it
was enough with the shed. Why isn't it enough with
because
the store?
Because in the hypothetical, I said it wouldn't be enough with the shed if the shed is used as a storage facility. Let's say the shed is 2 doors down from the store, and he uses, it's not really a shed, it's a building that he uses to circulate the inventory, which I'm sure is quite common, then that is in commerce, and that's what I said. I said if he has a private shed on his property that is not in commerce, and some of the inventory ends up there because he's withdrawn it from the store, that would not violate the statute. Clearly, under the case law, you cannot, as an individual, decide I'm no longer interested in my retail business, so I'm going to sneak back after the close of business, light it on fire, and because my own personal intent is that I'm tired of running the business, that it's no longer going to violate the arson statute.
I don't really see the difference.
Maybe.
But I think so. But if he's moved some of the input, burning down.
I think not, Your Honor, because I think, again, if he's circulating inventory and that's in commerce, that's the first thing that the statute's looking at. We have to see whether or not something is operating in commerce, and that's going to be fact-driven. So if he's just merely taken a couple of things, as he did routinely in this case, he would see inventory that he liked and decide he wanted to take it to Chicago to give to his friends. I think it's then become his personal property and it's no longer in commerce. So in this situation, again, we need to go back to these facts that we have. I see him over my time, but if I could just finish this last sentence. He has an operational retail store. It is at close of business. He waits a few hours and burns the store down with an accelerant in the dark of night with someone else with him. That clearly falls within the confines of the federal arson statute.
Was there testimony that the fire department was called?
I believe there was testimony that the fire department was called and that the there was inventory left in the store that was waterlogged.
Let me just ask you a quick question. I was puzzled by this joint motion to remand. If we were to reverse either the arson or the conspiracy or both, the resentencing would encompass more than what's in the joint motion, wouldn't it?
Yes. I think, would you like me to expound upon that?
Sure, go
ahead.
Okay.
It is obviously not an ideal situation to discover 5 days before oral argument that a defendant's sentencing guidelines were miscalculated. It wasn't an issue raised below. It wasn't an issue litigated in the appeal. But when I was preparing for oral argument and decided to take another look at, just to have greater familiarity with the money laundering guidelines, and went and looked at that and thought, this is wrong. It appears to be wrong. Then did the follow-up, called probation, talked to two supervisors there, called my appellate supervisor, called criminal appellate in D.C. and said, what does one do in this situation? Because it's not an issue in the appeal, but it's clearly something that as the department we want to see corrected. None of us want to see somebody get a life sentence when the guidelines were advisory life if that was an improperly calculated guidelines range. But I frankly, in 16 years of appellate...
Error?
I'm sorry?
Why not just confess error?
Well, we are confessing error, but the question was...
I haven't seen this joint. I don't understand.
It may have been the wrong thing to do, Judge Posner, but it's in 16 years of appellate work, I've never come across this issue. So in seeking guidance, actually from everyone from criminal appellate to your own clerk's office, and saying, what should we call this animal? How does one... We all know what we want to do, and we all know where we need to get to go. But what's the proper vehicle for this? Everybody's sort of scratching their heads because we don't come across this very often. And so, a motion to confess error, we didn't know what to call it. And I thought, I'm going to call defense counsel. Obviously, that's the first order of business. We were very quickly on the same page. We agreed that this needed to happen. I needed to somehow get around the waiver issue. And so we thought we'll do a joint motion for remand, which will be the most efficient way to put this before the court so that you're not reading different pleadings and that you see that we have a meeting of the minds and we both agree that this needs to happen. And that's a separate issue from the merits on the other two.
Okay, well, thanks, Mr. Mullen.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Anderson?
This won't be time. But if I hand this down to you, put an arrow on which one is the store. It's one of those two.
Your Honor, I don't know which of the two buildings on the left that it is, but it's one of those two, but I don't know which of those two that it is, because I haven't been to Peoria, so I haven't seen the store.
Is Ms. Mullen correct that there was testimony at the fire department was called?
Yes, Your Honor. They were conducting surveillance of the store, and so one of the officers followed the car as it was leaving, and and I believe the testimony was that he heard over the radio that the fire department had been called to the store. On the arson thing, just a couple of points. One, the district court rejected a finding that Mr. McBride knowingly endangered anyone in the arson. Two, on the hypothetical with the shed, if I have a shed that I'm using as a warehouse and it's full of candles, I can burn it down because it's my property, but I can't burn it down if I know someone else is inside there. And I can't burn it.
Here's what I'm confused about. What about the risk of harm to Mr. Price? He's standing right there next to the building when it's fire, you know, and then he runs, told to run, and he runs. Is there really a difference if he's standing right next to the building or if he's a foot inside the building?
Your Honor, one, I don't think we know just how close he was to the building. Two, again, I would note that the district court, in computing the guideline sentence, found that Mr. McBride did not knowingly endanger anyone, and knowledge is crucial for...
Well, no, but didn't he knowingly endanger the fireman?
Then the district court would have had to apply the sentencing enhancement.
If you burn a building, you assume that the fire department will... come, and firemen are killed. And not often, but it's not a trivial danger by any means. Not killed, you know, smoke inhalation.
I would disagree with you on that because the sentencing guidelines have a four-point enhancement for knowingly endangering any third party, including first responders, in connection with an arson. And so if all fires were inherently dangerous to third parties, then the sentencing commission would not have that four-point enhancement available.
The other guy was supposed to light the other end of the store. He obviously wasn't very good at it. But don't you think if you put accelerant at one end and with towels or whatever they were going to do, the defendant lights one end and this guy is supposed to light the other end, that's not exactly a safe venture that he knew and expected him to do. He was not happy with him because he didn't step up and light his end of the store.
I believe that the testimony is that Mr. McBride lit the fire before Mr. Head could get in place, and so I don't think there's any testimony in the record that Mr. Head put gasoline on the windowsill or did anything other than hang over by the sidewalk, and so I don't think there's any evidence in the record.
McBride fully expected him to.
Whether he did or didn't is irrelevant to whether he committed arson in this case. And again, if the court below would have thought that he knowingly endangered Mr. Head, the court would have implied the four-point enhancement, and the government would have argued for it below. But it didn't. And in terms of the commerce element, I would say that under Martin, this court says that you can take...
What did he sell in the store?
I don't know why he didn't.
No, what did he sell?
Oh, it was an urban clothing store, so it was maybe baggy jeans, that sort of thing. But I would say...
I don't have that picture. It's not in the appendix. Where'd you get that?
Have a brilliant law clerk.
Oh, well, I went too, but I don't have a picture.
Went to Peoria and took pictures.
Well, I assume one of these in the picture is the store, right?
I believe so, but again, I've never been there, so I don't know. But there was a picture of the store admitted into the record, and so I believe one of those is, but I don't know which of those two that it would be.
It's a food mart and... It's part of a, what do you call that, strip mall?
I don't think...
Is this a picture? Does you understand it? This is the picture. And his store is in the picture. He's got a sign here that says...
Yes, yes, yes.
Place. So he's yes. Part of it. So obviously...
And so I don't know whether all those buildings are connected...
among the others. Parking lot and has other stores nearby. If that's set on fire, if the fire department doesn't show up, could burn the rest of them.
Again, there was no testimony in the record.
In the picture. This picture is in evidence? I guess it is. I don't know.
And so it would just be whether you believe that there's a fair inference from the picture, but I would just say that there was no testimony in the record as to whether it had rained the night before or was it very humid, and a tinderbox, there's no testimony in the record as to the composition of the shingles.
Is there every expectation from customers and others the store is going to be open the next day? He just burned it in the middle of the night because he's tired of it.
But the relevant inquiry is not the customer's expectations. It's his expectation as to whether he intends to resume commerce. Well, and I would say that burning a building is a pretty good indication that you don't intend to resume commerce at the building.
Well, yeah, but it's also an unusual way. It's what Judge Posner suggests. You put a padlock on the door and you don't go there anymore.
Certainly not how I would have advised him to do it, Your Honor.
No, I don't. That's good to hear.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson. And you were appointed, were you not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, we thank you for your efforts on behalf of the client. We thank Ms. Mullen for her efforts as well.
You want your picture back?
No, keep it.
Thanks.
Okay, our next case for argument is Negroter Companies.